Welcome to the State of Hip Hop. I am your host, 6-4, Business Edition, taking the podcast new direction, man. I got my guy, Sidney Eugene, on. Say what's up with him, Sid.
What's good? What's good?
So, check it, man. I like to break the ice, man. This podcast is totally unscripted, man. You know, I break the ice. So let me ask you this. Yo, if you had to pick a dream record with your favorite producer, artist, an engineer, who would it be?
You know, that's easy for me, man. I can sum it all up with one. And I mean, I don't know if this is my favorite, but it certainly simplifies the answer. I'm going Ryan Leslie, man.
Okay.
I'm going Ryan, bro. Okay. Ryan and I get it in. Let him do his production thing. He's a pretty nice engineer as well. And then, you know, he's got them vocals, man. He's a great songwriter. It'd be an honor, you know?
Word. So now, give the world a little background on who you are and what you do, so we can, you know, solidify, you know, who I have on for this interview and for this podcast episode. So give me a little background, man, on who you are, what you do, how long you've been in the game, all that good stuff.
Well, cool. So I'll keep it a little short and sweet, you know. One of those things is a little something about me is I don't like to too much blow my own horn, but I'll give you a little bit about me. So I started in the music business when I was 6 years old. My first record deal when I was six. Was traveling the world and on radio by the age of seven. I got in a bad deal, which happens to a lot of first artists that, you know, don't know the business. My parents knew the business, but not well enough to keep that from happening. And we got shut down. At the age of 16, I became the youngest living music exec starting at Warner Brothers in the marketing department. I did it directly with the vice president of sales at the time. So he was working with Faith Hill, so I had the privilege of being a part of her career. That's the first artist I got a chance to work with directly. And then I did 20 plus years on Music Row, leaving there, going to UMG, and then finally ended up at Sony. And that's pretty much it, man. I spent so much time on the road. I got a chance to see some really cool deals and work with some of my my idols and see a lot of great artists start up. You know, a lot of talented artists not get as far as they probably could have if they had the insight. And so it kind of prompted me, being an artist, to put together something that could help artists. And so we started this thing called the Help Desk. Started that in 2013. Ran an artist through it as a guinea pig, and she ended up becoming number one on the charts. And we realized we had something, and we put it into play. And I did that up until I retired in 2015. And I went and sat on the beach for a few years. I had a really good name on Music Row, so some of those people I did deals with continued to reach out to me, and it was just clear that I wasn't done. And I felt like I needed to contribute more. Like there was a lot more to, you know, to be done for me to contribute to our industry. And one thing led to another. Then, you know, I was kind of back in action, just helping artists. Because I realized I retired from the music business, but I didn't retire from music. I love music.
Right.
And so I kind of wanted to be done with the business, but I wanted to be as involved in music as possible. And so, yeah, I just got back into helping. And the best way for me to do that became education, because in our business, that's seldomly heard. You know, most of the times it's pay me for what I know and I'll do what I can do, but I won't tell you anything.
Right.
And so
right.
Once your resources dry up, then you can't pay the guy anymore, and now you don't even know what to do.
Real. Live hung out to dry.
You get the information. And so I said, well, let's see if we could do something differently. And so I became an educator. And we started what's now called MBE, which is Music Business Essentials. And we're doing all that we can to educate the creative community. And so that's where I am right now.
Word. So real quick, what age was you when you retired?
That's a good question. So that was 2015. You know, I try to do the whole out of sight, out of mind thing when it comes to the age. You know, and I think it's just because...
Right.
You know, it's interesting enough. Let me put the precursor there before I do the math on it. But the precursor to this is I found out that every black male that I met in my generation, for some reason, we all thought we were going to die at 25. I don't know why. I don't know if it was the music that we were listening to at the time. I don't know if it was us being heavily influenced by Tupac, or if it was our culture, or I really don't know. But I've met perfect strangers around the same age as me. And I'm, hey, man, just talk to them. And I thought I was going to die at 25. Are you kidding me? I thought I was just me. Like, you know, so I went on this real reckless path around that age because I felt like I was clocking out. So, and so pretty much after 25, I kind of stopped counting because I wasn't prepared for anything past that. But what I will say is I'll be 44 this year. And so that would, if we dial back 5 years, that would have made me 39.
That's a blessing, man, for real. So now we got a little background on who you are. We finna come right back. This is the State of Hip Hop 101, me and Sid. Welcome back to the State of Hip Hop. I am your host, 6-4, 101 with Sidney Eugene himself. So now the class that you teach, the MBE class, a lot of people, and me especially, it's like I got to a point where I needed to know everything I needed to know about the music industry and things that I didn't know that I needed to know, if you follow what I'm saying.
Because
We know that this game is full of sharks. And if you don't protect yourself, if you don't know the lingo, if you don't understand the terminology, and you don't understand how to read a contract and interpret them and move forward on what you should and should not do, you're only setting yourself up for failure. I mean, and there's plenty cases out that where artists don't fully understand a contract, or they don't fully understand what's in the contract, whether it be, you know, a producer artist agreement, an engineering artist agreement, or a major artist agreement, whether it be a 360 or whatever, or a startup or whatever. This, tell me about how your class that you teach relates to those scenarios in today's music world.
Well, really, the way I look at it is kind of a pulling back of the veil. So just to kind of break it up so that it's clear where we're coming from. So the way I was educated, like I say, coming in to working directly with the VP of Warner Brothers at the time, the way I was educated was that there's a music industry and there's an inner industry. And the inner industry represents 1% of the music industry. So you have 99% that are on the outside of the office and what's taking place with us. And so kind of my first example of that was in 1993 when we decided we were going to issue the statement that CDs weren't selling. And so CDs were selling just fine. In fact, they were trending. It wasn't an issue with CD selling.
And we're talking 93, not 03, not 83.
Right, we're talking about 1993. CDs are doing really well. In fact, they're doing better than they were in 92. But I was in the boardroom and I heard the president and the vice presidents were sitting around all talking. And it was kind of like, okay, we need to say CDs aren't selling. And all it was that those bonus checks were going from $10 million to $8 million. Okay. And this is just bonus. This is not based off of anything hard. It's just bonus checks, you know, incentives to just keep doing what we do. And it was, okay, we can't, we got to do something. And so the statement went out, CDs aren't selling. And immediately I saw the impact on our community. Next, I saw the impact on the industry and how, you know, technology and everything just started to change. You know, we had the influx of Pro Tools and people doing things themselves. You know, Fruity Loops, all these things were taking off. People were really starting doing things on their own. And next thing you know, it was kind of the digital age of music that we have now. And I say that to say this, that was created by 1% of our industry. That whole movement was created by 1% of our industry. And so whenever it came to trying to figure out how to impact the 99% from a front end versus a back end scenario where you're just responding or, you know, reacting, it was evident to me that we needed to get this information out in a way that could be received. And so the way we've tried to approach it is from thinking as artists. Like I say, I started as an artist, so I still think as an artist, even though I'm well-versed in the business, I still have that creative mind. So it's like, okay, how do we get this information to artists where they are so that it can impact their careers positively, so they don't have the 20-year story, like, oh, I've been doing music 20 years and nothing's worked. And then they come to us after they've exhausted their creative spurts or, you know, their resources, and they're just kind of like hoping for that last leg of their career to be profitable. So we've tried to attack them where they are, like approach them where they are, like make it ground level. Okay, so if you're in the studio, we try to say, okay, well, what are the agreements that you need? We just throw out that information. Okay, did you know the law? We try to bring the law down to a layman's term. Did you know what the law is in regards to who owns your masters? And put it in real life examples. Like I mentioned Tupac earlier. Like, okay, Tupac passes away, and then there's five new Tupac CDs. How is this possible? So we know with creators, we have to get it to them in a way that they can really get it, and basically giving them the tools of empowerment so that if we galvanize that 99%, then it so much doesn't matter they don't know the lingo, or it so much doesn't matter that they might not be in that office. Like I can say, during my tenure of 20 plus years on Music Row, within the inner industry, I probably had lunch with 15 people. That's 20 plus years. So I'll let you know how small this group of people is. So you may not ever be in that room. You may not ever go to lunch with one of us, but we know that you don't need us, that we need you. And so if we can get that impression to cross over to the minds of the creators, then it puts the power back in their hands. And they're no longer standing in line hoping somebody likes them. They're no longer trying to get on a competition show and hope they get the votes. They're taking advantage of those opportunities and using them as a main stage for their own craft. So it's like, now you may be trying to get on that competition show, but not so that you can win it, just so that you can get on there and reach more people. You know, and so that's kind of been our approach is, yeah, there's an industry out here that you may want to break into. And yeah, it is predetermined based off of your knowledge. But if you can use that same information to empower yourself, you're going to get better results than if you're using that same information from a powerless standpoint, trying to approach it with someone that seems to be in a decision-making or a gatekeeper position, you know?
Right.
And so that's kind of our thing. It's like, yeah, you should be able to have a decent conversation with a licensed placement company or something like that and be able to know what they're talking about. I mean, some of the stuff I didn't get into application. So, I mean, I did my first major, like, worldwide release with Sony in 2014. And some of those terms I didn't know up until then. I had already been on Music Row 20 plus years. And I didn't know some of the terms. It was like, hey, we need this. And there are certain little things they were asking for. And I didn't know those words until I actually had to apply it. It was like, okay, send this over. And I had to find out what that was, you know? And you know, it's one of those scenarios where you couldn't too much ask because they presume that you know already.
So right.
Maybe you're not qualified for this, you know what I'm saying? So some of that stuff's going to come out on its own, you know, like perfect practice makes perfect. So some of it's just going to come out in application. But I think our main approach, what makes MBE special, in my opinion, is that our approach is really just kind of pulling back the veil so that people can realize we're just human. We're regular people. I don't say just human like there's, you know, a reason just human, but we're human just like everyone else. The decision makers are human just like everyone else. And so if you had lessened that type of, you know, pedestal point of view and humanize these people, I think it really makes it where you say, like, oh, well, maybe I could do this myself. And I think we see that now. We see all these artists that are just doing that now, like, you know, like the Rascals and the, you know, the Chances and the, you know, the Billie Eilishes and these artists that are just like, you know what, maybe I'll just do it myself and see how it turns out. And then they end up learning the lingo. And even then, there's still that trial or error scenario, which look at Billie Eilish, you know, the number's so low, it's $2.5 million. Like, wow, okay. So, yeah, there is something to knowing, because if she knew, I guarantee she could have got 10 times as much. You know, if she knew her value, she could have easily won it. I mean, there are people there are people that don't have near her impact on the music community, and they're getting bigger deals than us, you know. So, yeah, there is something to knowing what to say and how to say it to the right people. But at the same time, if you hone your craft properly, like I'm sure she will, she'll learn that, you know, in process. And so, yeah, that's kind of our thing, is minimizing the curve as much as we can, getting people to see where they are, to be able to apply the techniques we give them in a way that gives them the results they're looking for and cuts out a few people in the process.
Man, that's a heavy load, and I can't put it no other way. And it's a heavy load that I need to educate and arm myself with. Because, you know, it's easy for you to say, but for the person who doesn't know, this is a gem in itself. Because first off, the information, and information is king. I don't care how you look at it, information is number one. That's the one that's going to drive every decision. Because if you don't know, you're going to make a half-cocked decision on something. And, you know, just to give you a case in point, it's like, you know, I learned about releasing music just here in the last year. Now, I'll be the first one to tell you, I've got 4 studio albums out. Who knows about them? Not a lot of people. Why? Because I didn't know how to do a release. And I started back with this in 16. So, you know, fast forward to now, I'm sitting here on all this music, and I figured out, hey, you need to put some sort of marketing plan with a release, or it's just gonna jump out and fall flat. Hey, and if nobody knows who you are, it's not gonna behoove you to put out a whole album, because you don't have anything to gain any traction with. So you maybe should have put out a single and pushed that for almost a year or a couple quarters to see what kind of traction you can get off of it. Then that would help you discover your fan base. And then that would give you an idea on how to, you know, put them analytics to work, and how and where and who to push your album to. And this is where I figured out that where all the ads come in, like all your Facebook ads and your Instagram ads and just your marketing in general, when you discover and figure that out, that's where you can grow from. But if you don't have a plan for it, then guess what? That dead air is what's going to be. Nothing.
Right.
So this is the second session of the one-on-one interview with Sid. This is the State of Hip Hop. We're going to be right back. This is the State of Hip Hop. I am your host, 6-4, one-on-one, Sidney Eugene, in here dropping gems today, man. I sure appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule to come rock with me today. So, Q&A. So, just to clear up a lot of confusion about the word masters. Now, if you go into a studio without your engineer artist agreement, who controls your masters? Just so the world knows.
Oh, that's an easy one right there. So the interpretation of the law is that whatever device captures the recording contains the ownership. So if you're going to the studio and you're just empty-handed, you're going in with your notepad, if that, you know, then it's a good case that a good chance rather that the studio is going to own your masters. So you always want to have that paperwork. Like we say, there's always 3 agreements that every major artist goes into the studio with, and 5 if you have a supporting cast. But there's always 3. You're always going to have your split sheet. You're going to have that, like you said, that engineer agreement and that studio agreement. And then there becomes, you know, you need to add a few more in if you're using production or that type of stuff. If you're using other people's contributions, then there are a few different pieces of paperwork to go along with that. But there is a trick to the trade with it if you just really want to get really cool about it and creative, because some people, as soon as bring up paperwork, they just, I don't know, and especially in certain genres. So there's an easy way around it. You just want to have your own hard drive. You want to come in with your hard drive and you want to say, I don't record on anything but my hard drive. And then at least that way, the device that's capturing your recording is yours. So you then retain that ownership. Now, that doesn't get you around the engineer. The engineer's contribution is still going to require a piece of paper. That gets you around the studio portion of it, and like you say, the default ownership scenario in regards to your masters. But yeah, you still want to have that other paperwork just to secure your traction moving forward.
Now, that's game. If a lot of people say they just go to studio and they're like, you know, I'm leaving with that, man. Your studio owns the stuff. If you go to a studio and you don't have your paperwork in place, this is the main reasons why I ask these questions, because a lot of people don't know. A lot of people think that it's the other way around. They think that just because you write it on a piece of paper and you go record it somewhere, if you're not recording it at your own house on your own hard drive, and you go somewhere, then it's theirs. If you don't have your paperwork in place. Now,
absolutely.
The next question. Closed session or open session?
That one's super easy. I mean, you can ask Rick Ross about that one. Universal, I always thought it was super cool that you couldn't enter the studio without signing the paperwork. It didn't matter if you were coming in just to get the trash. You had to sign that, your name on that clipboard, coming in, get the trash, and you go back out. The same with Warner Brothers. I was at Warner Brothers for a decent period of my life, and I never stepped foot in the studio. I saw it several times, but as far as going inside, I didn't have any business to be in there. And so I'm always going to say closed session on that one. Unless you're in a collective, you're in a creative collective where you're in a jam session, then obviously, you know, you need to have that open session so everybody feels entitled to their contribution. What I'd say is that's few and far between, and if you are doing it, you still want to have that group paperwork before you even go in, so that you guys all kind of agree on what the terms are before you can get started with the creativity. It's always better to handle the paperwork before the creativity, because afterwards, everybody's contribution is magnified. That's just how it goes. I mean, that's what happened with Ross and happens with so many other people. It's like, oh, if I hadn't added that one word in, we wouldn't have went platinum, you know? And so so you always want to take care of that on the front end. And I'm going to go closed session with that just for the sake of, you know, ownership and legalities.
So to put this in layman terms of what he just said was, okay, let's say you want to go record. You take two or three of your homeboys. So you're in there dropping your verse. And your homeboy's like, hey, why don't you, you know what I'm saying? This might sound better if you do it like this. Okay. So on top of the fact that you didn't make sure that your paperwork was in order, and now you're running, you got an open session that nobody's thinking about. Your homeboy gets mad because you take off and you hit 4 million in the first week on Apple. So on your Apple sale, so he's like, hey man, you need to break me off some of that. Guess what's gonna happen? Your artist is finna have to stand and answer some questions in court because he didn't have his paperwork ready. He didn't have that right. He didn't make sure, he thought it was all good, but people turn on you, and I've seen it happen.
Of course.
So,
and in that case, just to drop this here really quick, you only have to prove two things. One is that you had access. That's the biggest one. So if you can prove that you have access, pretty much got you a lawsuit. And then two is your contribution. So if your buddy has it down that this is what he said, and he can prove he was in the studio, yeah, you got a lawsuit on your hands.
Yeah, you got a big problem on your hands. Just to keep it 100, man, that's a big problem waiting to be put out, man. Nobody want no smoke with that, man. For real. And the final question I'm going to ask before we wrap this up. Indie or label?
You know, for us, we'd always say it like this. Do you want to buy your own groceries? That's it.
So, hey man, that's so a hell of an analogy right
whenever,
there, man.
That's how we would do it. Whenever an artist would come in our office, like they want to sign a Sony or something, we just say, well, do you want to buy your own groceries? And if they said yes, they want to buy their own groceries, then we'd push them the indie route. Because obviously, you know, that means they want more ownership. They want to be the boss. They don't mind being on the front line. They don't mind, you know, shaking hands and doing that type of thing. They may even take a back end route where you know, you never know who they are, but they're, you know, eating very well and living lucratively off of music. But if they said, no, I don't want to buy my groceries, then we knew we needed to take them the major route. And then that's more of the insulating them with the manpower. And then, you know, you push them on a pedestal and they become more of a face of a brand rather than the actual brand. And so, yeah, I think it's going to depend on you. If you're an introvert, then you certainly want to be an indie, because you're going to get to call the shots. If you're an extrovert, you don't mind, you know, delegating and someone else kind of being over your career with leverage or without, then you go the major route. And, you know, I used to be, I was never really anti-major, but I used to be like pro-indie, I'd say that. And then after setting up 17 or more record labels, I realized not everybody has what it takes to be an indie. You know, it takes a lot of courage. It takes a lot of discipline, you know, and to take that and couple it with creativity, you know, I think it's a masterpiece. And so the people that you see that reach this scale of success that is notable, that, you know, they make it on our radar, those are really special people. You know, I mean, because you have so many independent people that are out here every day making six figures and you don't know who they are. I think they actually make up the bulk of indies. You know, so 40%+ of our industry is independent record labels. They have our three major labels, which Warner, Sony, UMG.
So you put that in perspective. So you get 60%. The other 60% is major, compared to the 40% of indie.
So that's something that to take in, you know, to consideration, that you don't have to be on the marquee. You can be making six figures a year and just be, you know, a regular independent artist that, you know, you monetized in your community. People know you, they respect you, but you can still go into your grocery store, or you can still go shopping without closing the mall down. So yeah, I think it kind of depends on you, your personality type, what you're cut out for, what you'd, you know, the type of lifestyle you'd have to have. But for me, I say as long as you got your music out and to the people that like it, then it doesn't matter. If it takes a label deal, I recommend you not going to the major. Let the major come to you. And then, you know, from an indie standpoint, obviously you get to call the shots. And you still want to have a good team around you, man. The most successful indies, they still have a team around them. Even the do-it-yourselfers, like, I did everything myself, like the rest is and stuff. He still has a hell of a team, you know, a really good team around him that kind of makes his job a lot easier.
Word. And that's the business. So this is the State of Hip Hop, man. Sid, I appreciate you coming to rock with me one time and getting
my pleasure.
And we're going to do this every week, man. We're going to take this. We're going to go and let it grow and grow and grow. We're going to inform y'all and give y'all the business and the games, man, so you can equip yourself with these tools that these people giving you, because information is free in most cases. Now, the game is free, but you got to know how to take it in and do something with it. This is our time, y'all. This is the State of Hip Hop. Love.